Word of the day today is stagflation, yet another bad thing that happened in the 1970s and maybe in the late 2000-teens from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, November the 14th. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. What I'm about to say is going to make it two out of the last 3 days, I believe, that we are starting this radio program with the bond market. But the news is what the news is, right? The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, the interest that bond pays, in other words, ended this day at 2.25%. Nothing extraordinary there, not all that high, except that it closed on election day at 1.74%. So a not small jump. I put you through all of that, and I apologize, but I put you through it because of this. If you roll together the president-elect's plans to grow this economy, the tax cuts and the increased spending on infrastructure and defense, if you roll that in with his plans to tighten restrictions on trade and cutting back hard on immigration, we might not be looking at growth so much as we're looking at stagflation, rising interest rates, those bonds, and stagnant growth. That is a bad thing economy-wise, one we haven't lived through since, as I mentioned, the 1970s. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has our primer.
I happen to like them, but go ahead. Blame the anchovies. They all but disappeared from Peruvian waters in the 70s. At the same time, the Soviet Union gobbled up millions of tons of grain, which drove up prices of that commodity. And then two big oil shocks.
Both the 1974-75 oil shock and the 1979 shock associated with the Iranian Revolution.
Alexander Field teaches economics at Santa Clara University. He says higher oil prices mean higher prices elsewhere in the economy.
It also means that the productive capability of the United States was reduced by what OPEC did in the 70s, because we could get, you know, the terms of trade when it gets us, we could get a lot less oil for the same quantity of our exports.
All that led to a little something called stagflation.
Oh, that dreaded word.
Kent Hughes is a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center.
It was such a difficult time, and by the time we reached the end of the 1970s, that's how people described the economy. It was essentially the worst of both worlds, high inflation and no growth.
This meant rising prices and less economic opportunity. People lost their jobs, and even for those with jobs, their incomes were worth less because of high inflation.
So your living standard essentially goes down in a very dramatic way.
Mauro Gillen teaches international management at the Wharton School. Bottom line, he says,
you really want to avoid stagflation. That's not something that we should be looking forward to.
The good news is we can avoid it. We have more capacity to produce oil now, and we're less dependent on it. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Campaign promises are part of every presidential race. Big, sweeping campaign promises. Among Mr. Trump's, 25 million new jobs, 4% economic growth, repeal and replace Obamacare, better trade deals, America first. To get there, $500 billion at least in new infrastructure spending, deportation of undocumented immigrants, crackdowns on refugees, and a pullback from the global economy. In the weeks and months to come, we're going to be taking a good long look at the new administration's economic pledges and the way they are going to impact race and class and income inequality in this country in a series we are going to call The Big Promise. We begin today with President-elect's repeated pledge to cut off federal funds to sanctuary cities. Marketplace's Rima Crace reports.
Here's what it means to 22-year-old Thais Marquez to be in a sanctuary city. Marquez is undocumented and lives in Newark, New Jersey.
It means that I can be safe in my own city. If I get pulled over or if something happens, I know that my family won't be detained and I won't be detained.
More than 300 cities, counties, and states are so-called sanctuary places. Dan Kesselbrenner is the executive director of the National Immigration Project. He says there's no legal definition of a sanctuary city, but generally they have policies that keep government employees from cooperating with federal immigration enforcement.
So if you look up the local ordinances in New York and Chicago and L.A., it'll say, you know, don't contact these people when someone is seeking services.
Donald Trump has pledged to block federal funding to sanctuary cities. Illinois Comptroller-elect Susana Mendoza says Trump's plan,
It's morally corrupt, but more importantly as well, it's fiscally unsound.
Mendoza says it's not clear how much money Chicago would lose, but it'd be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. San Francisco has a city budget of more than $9 billion, with more than $400 million from the federal government.
You know, 5% of the budget is fairly significant.
Severin Campbell is with the city's Budget and Legislative Analyst's Office. She says San Francisco would lose grants for housing and community programs.
There's also a lot of grants, for instance, criminal justice grants that show up like in the police and adult probation budgets.
The Senate blocked a bill earlier this year to cut federal funding for sanctuary cities, but says Alex Narasta, an immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute.
These resolutions, these amendments have already been written. The idea has been out there for a very long time.
And he says with a Republican Congress and a Republican in the White House, a lot of cut off sanctuary cities is certainly possible. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, steady as she goes on Trump plus six. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The actual campaigning part of the presidential campaign that ended last Tuesday lasted 500-something days. The next part of our national political conversation is far more finite, just 67 days left till Inauguration Day, which means not a whole lot of time to get a whole lot of work done. Hand over control of the entire federal government from one administration to the next. 4,000 political appointees, give or take, and many, many more jobs beyond that. Given, though, that the president-elect has repeatedly said he is going to drain the swamp that he believes Washington to be, some agencies inside the Beltway are in for a rough couple of months. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that one.
Out on the campaign trail, Donald Trump didn't parse words about which federal agencies he wanted to reduce or even close entirely. Take, for instance, this conversation with Fox News' Bill O'Reilly.
One big thing you're going to cut right away.
I'm going to cut big, big Department of Education, as an example.
It was comments like these that were fresh on the minds of Department of Education employees when they woke up on Wednesday morning, wondering if their jobs might soon vanish.
How we felt coming to work after that, people were shocked. Everybody was shocked.
Jacob McKenzie works with the Department of Education. Walking briskly on his way from work to the D.C. subway, he says it isn't just his job that he's worried about, but the students and kids themselves.
It's very early to tell, but it's kind of like, this guy has no idea what he's doing, and we have to sit on the sideline and watch our children's future go down the drain.
The Department of Education isn't the only agency to be singled out by Trump for cuts. The Environmental Protection Agency has been a thorn in the side of the GOP for a long time.
We're going to save on Department of Environmental Protection because they're not doing it. They're not doing their job, and they're making it impossible for our country to compete.
Under Obama, working to fight climate change was a driving mission of the EPA. Trump, on the other hand, is said to be considering someone from the fossil fuel industry to lead the agency. Tom Reynolds was a senior staffer at the EPA and later served as an advisor to the Obama White House on climate change.
I think people are going to think long and hard about whether they want to be part of that.
I asked Reynolds, campaign rhetoric aside, is it really possible to gut an entire federal agency? Can a president just do that?
It's easier than you think. The president appoints a cabinet that reflects his priorities and carries out his marching orders.
In the weeks and months to come, Trump's transitional team will come up with a short list of names for top cabinet positions, as well as some 4,000 political appointees.
Transitions are interesting because they do give an indication of sort of how someone's going to govern.
Jeff Navin was a former chief of staff in the Department of Energy under Obama. Like the EPA, Navin says the Energy Department will also likely see a big culture change under Trump. Still, he says most career bureaucrats are used to these kinds of power shifts.
You know, there are people that work at DOE that are all in on the Trump agenda, and there are people who woke up the day after the election and thought, that's not what I was hoping the outcome would be. But they all know what they're signing up for when they take those jobs.
However Washington feels about Trump, Mark Dubowitz of the National Security Think Tank, the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, says the business of the country can't wait.
Oh, timing is of the essence. I mean, there's a very short window for the transition.
For starters, Dubowitz says, there's currently a long list of international crises besetting the U.S.
For that reason, you'll see national security professionals from the GOP, for the most part, putting aside some of the concerns they have and really stepping up for the good of the country.
Meanwhile, the list of names being tossed around for key posts in Trump's cabinet is providing D.C. with one of its favorite diversions, endless rounds of speculation about who will get those top jobs. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Politicians, it turns out, are just like business people. They pay close attention to cash inflows and outflows. They run marketing operations second to none. And when a long, hard-fought campaign, a product launch, to extend the metaphor here, when it goes against them, they know what they got to do. They got to rebrand. With the Republicans' clean sweep last Tuesday, Democrats are going to be in a tough spot come January. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now on the rebalancing ahead for the party.
For Democrats, it's time for some soul searching. So says Tad Devine, a longtime Democratic strategist.
Well, Trump as president is going to result in effectively a civil war within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is going to look for new leadership at the local, state, and national level to deal with a President Trump.
And in terms of the Democratic economic agenda, yeah, that's pretty much shot. So Devine says they will have to go on the defense.
And the Democratic Party will have to come together in principled opposition to President Trump, but in constant opposition to him. And we cannot allow him to begin to implement the policies that he advocated.
Of particular concern for Devine and other Democrats, Trump's tax plan, which would cut taxes for the wealthy and corporations. For his part, President-elect Trump is promising to work with everyone. He even brought it up in his victory speech.
For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
But really, it won't be easy for Democrats. With the GOP in control of the House and the Senate and the White House, they'll have limited options to shift economic policy.
The Democratic Party is not going to have much to say.
David Carroll teaches government and politics at the University of Maryland. He says Democrats will mostly have their hands tied in Congress.
In the Senate, the minority still retains the right to filibuster, but you can't filibuster the budget resolution. And a lot can be packed in to the budget.
But there's always Washington's favorite pastime, deal making. There could be an opportunity for Democrats to pick off members of Trump's own party.
It is not clear that the moderate Republicans will actually go along with some of the more extreme stances with Trump.
Sharon O'Halloran teaches politics and economics at Columbia University. With so little control, she says Democrats will have a lot of incentive to reach across the aisle.
And therefore, you may be able to have a coalition between the Democrats as well as the moderate Republicans, pushing the more extreme Republicans to the wings.
And that, says O'Halloran, can open the door to negotiating with President-elect Trump. That will be critical on contentious votes and presidential appointments that help shape the U.S. economy. Because even if Democrats want to use obstruction as a tool, they may not want to be called out for it. Here's why. O'Halloran says the Democrats are already thinking ahead.
And I think that's going to be one of their key goals, is to make sure that the government does continue to function and that they can be seen as responsible. And then they look to the next election.
For political parties, it's never too early to start thinking about the next campaign, even if the rest of us might want a bit of a break. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there aren't a lot of British-made products in this industry.
Brexit backfires on the British music industry, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 21 points today, 10%, 18,868. The NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.3%, 5218. The S&P 500 flat, 21.64. Samsung Electronics is unlocking the door to connected cars with plans to buy Harman International. Harman is the maker of audio systems and safety features for automakers, among other things. Revved up more than 25%. BMW up 0.9%. Also in the buy column, German engineering firm Siemens is buying an Oregon-based Mentor Graphic. It helps semiconductor companies design and test chips. It's a way for Siemens to keep up in automated manufacturing, is what the analysts are saying. Siemens up 0.8% today. Mentor Graphics up 18%. Banks are seeing green with rising bond yields, as I was talking about. Wells Fargo deposited 2.8% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good news for the National Football League. The viewership numbers for last night's Seahawks-Patriots game are in. More than 22 million people watched, the highest audience figure since the beginning of this season. Could it be that now that the bruising and many would say toxic campaign we just lived through is finally over, people are ready for a bit of an escape? Yeah, it could. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is on that one.
After Tuesday night, Daniel Larea just needed to decompress.
I myself saw three movies this weekend.
Larea is an editor for the entertainment trade publication Box Office Media. People flooded theaters the past few days. Box office revenue was up as much as 50% over the same weekend last year, with folks checking out Doctor Strange, Trolls, and Arrival.
I think this weekend was a great opportunity for the American public to be able to disconnect from the headlines a little bit.
Distractions seem to be on tap for lots of us. If it wasn't movies or sports, it may have been the kids' soccer or even making plans for Thanksgiving next week.
Just getting outside your own head is really helpful.
Northeastern University psychology professor Lisa Feldman Barrett says our nervous systems have evolved to deal with periodic big stressful events, the lion chasing us on the savanna. What our systems don't handle so well is the constant drip of low-grade stress, the obsessing over the campaign, and now the obsessing over the election results and its aftermath.
When you don't get enough sleep, when you're on social media too much, this is extraordinarily costly to a human nervous system.
When people are stressed, Feldman Barrett says they tend to lock in and get stuck like flypaper. Finding a way to pay attention to something else, to separate yourself from the anxiety, is a way to free yourself up. This weekend, Feldman Barrett went to see Doctor Strange with her family. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The economic implications of last Tuesday's election are going to take a while to play out. But right now, businesses are figuring out how they're going to adapt to the change in administrations. Last week, we talked to Lisa Goldenberg about this. She's the CEO of Delaware Steel, and we talked about her plans. Today, another person we talk to from time to time, Alana Furco, is the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall out in Butte, Montana. Hey, Alana.
Hi, Kai.
As you get out and about the mall the past, 48 hours or so, what are you hearing from customers? What's the mood?
You know, I think a lot of relief that it's over. There's no more uncertainty. And, you know, we just go forward. There's a lot of relief.
Was it busier on Wednesday than usual? I mean, did you see people out and about?
You know, actually, I am going to say yes. It did seem to be busy. And maybe there was an emotional factor. Maybe people wanted to be out and about and visit.
Yeah.
Yeah, not necessarily shop, but maybe they just wanted to be together and help process what happened on Election Day.
Right, and we should say here that Butte is in a county that Hillary Clinton won solidly, but the rest of the state went for Mr. Trump.
It did, and, you know, actually, we also voted a Democratic governor. Hmm. So, we try to keep a healthy balance.
Yeah. One of the reasons we called you, Alana, was to talk about Christmas and retail and the idea of uncertainty in this economy as we have the transition to a Trump administration. Any sense of that from your merchants and your store owners?
Well, you know, we all watched the stock market, just like I think the rest of America did. I think from today, we're 2 weeks out to Thanksgiving, which is my favorite holiday. I think we all are very grateful to be Americans. This is a great nation, no matter what your politics. And I think people will spend for Christmas. We always do. And I guess we just go forward and hopefully with all the shenanigans and the upset behind us, we can focus on a better tomorrow.
You personally, how did this election affect you?
You know, I'm going to tell you, I did vote for Hillary. I hoped to see the first woman president in my lifetime. I am going to say I'm going to put my faith behind the president-elect, and I believe he has it in his heart to do good by our nation.
Alana Furco is the manager at the Butte Plaza Mall. She is in Butte, Montana. Alana, thanks very much.
Take care, sir, and happy holidays.
You too. Continuing now with stories from the Marketplace desk of unexpected election results, Brexit. The pound sterling is down 20% against the dollar since that vote back in June. And that is doing a number on businesses in the UK, big and small. The BBC's Edwin Lane takes us to London's Tin Pan Alley, famous for its musical instrument trade.
It's a short street of four- and five-story buildings, but in the 50s and the 60s, this was really the centre of British pop music industry. It used to be full of music publishers and recording studios. People like the Rolling Stones and Elton John recorded here. Even the Sex Pistols apparently lived here, just above number 6 in the 1970s. But since then, it's become famous less for its recording studios and more for its dozens of shops selling musical instruments. And in particular, if you want to buy a guitar in London, this is the place to come.
We've got two examples of American-made Fenders here. This guitar, for the money, it's a 52 reissue, and it is the level of detail and the attention is unbelievable. It's a very accurate reissue.
Crispin Weir is the director of Regent Sounds, a Denmark Street guitar shop that specialises in Fender guitars, high-end, American-made instruments that sell for hundreds or even thousands of dollars.
The body is made of ash, the neck is made of maple. The quality of this guitar for the money is absolutely fantastic, but this was a sort of £1,200 guitar. It's now going to be a sort of £1,500, £1,600 guitar very soon, and so it's quite a huge increase in terms of, you know, for anybody, £1,200 is a lot of money, £1,600 is a hell of a lot more.
And that's the problem for Crispin and UK guitar sellers like him. The fall in the value of the pound means guitars imported from America just got a whole lot more expensive. He's already put his prices up by as much as 40%, and he's worried that more increases are on the way.
There aren't a lot of British-made products in this industry, but, you know, it's largely an American business. Importing is expensive. I mean, we've just seen huge, huge price rise. It's still very shocking when you actually look at the bottom line and you go, my God, something's gone up by 40%. You know, at this point, what's it going to go up? You know, it'll be 100% within a year. You know, you don't know. So it is shocking, yeah.
That's a huge jump. Do you think that kind of price jump is going to put some people off buying this guitar who may have considered it before?
Yes. It's not easy for people, but we've been fortunate because, of course, the paradox is that, you know, suddenly we've got a lot more kind of European tourists who are kind of coming over, and obviously the pound is now the same as a euro, so a lot of people coming over because it's cool to buy a guitar in London, and it's cool. So where we've lost sales domestically, we've made up for them in tourism. So, we're running at about the same sort of level.
The economic cost of Britain's exit from the European Union remains to be seen. But with the pound in its depressed state, higher prices mean Britain's guitar shops and players are left feeling a little blue.
Edwin Lane there from the BBC. The This final note on the way out today. You remember how after Brexit there were those stories about how "what is Brexit" was the top Google search term over in the UK? Yeah, file this one under "what goes around comes around." Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people, they tweeted last night that their top list of word searches the past week or so is in this order: fascism, bigot, xenophobe, racism, socialism, resurgence, xenophobia, and misogyny. I'm just going to leave that right there. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 21 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 18. That is 0.3%. The S&P 500, not a zip zero. Bupkis. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.